This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, fishing, wildlife conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle. DSC's Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Taurus, Award-Winning Pistols and Revolvers, Mossberg, American Built, American Strong, and the Red 55 Winery in Lindale, Texas, signature wines of Grammy Award-winning country artist Miranda Lambert and owned by Rick and Beverly Lambert.
During the past few weeks, I've had the opportunity to spend time with some absolutely fantastic people, different places, things that I've done with Luke Clayton, such as the rendezvous that we do every year in March there in Greenville, Texas, and prior to that, a couple of different other places, plus some time spent with DSC members scattered all over the country in terms of not only visiting in person, but also receiving emails. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time talking to people. And one of the things that I've learned is that, you know, people have questions and sometimes they think you have all the answers, you being me. And that's not always the case. But one of the things I've also learned that if I don't know the answer to some question, what I'm going to do is I'm going to find somebody that does, who is truly an expert and an authority in that part of whatever that question involves. What I thought we'd do today is just pull some of the questions that I've had over the last, oh my gosh, say the last 4 or 5 weeks, maybe 6 weeks when you get right down to it. But I've spent, as I said, a lot of time visiting with people, and we're hitting into the springtime and into the summertime before too very long, and it allows a good time to do a lot of different things outdoors, including hunting, fishing, and of course getting ready for the next hunting season. But also getting ready to do some things as far as habitat work is concerned. Now, my background, of course, is as a wildlife biologist. I set up management programs all over the southern half of Texas and lots of other parts of the state, and of course other states, and in Canada and in Mexico and Africa and a little bit in Europe and in Australia and a few other places during the times when I had the opportunity to be there as either as a wildlife biologist or as a hunter back when I was doing different TV shows. And specifically the last bunch of years, I was doing Trailing the Hunter's Moon, which was based on a book that I wrote back in 2004. Now, 24 years ago. My gracious, I did an update to that a few years ago, a self-published one that Trailing the Hunter's Moon, The Adventure Continues. We did that as a limited edition of about 250 copies, and basically those are gone. We've sold every one of those copies, and they're kind of hard to come by, so Thinking about doing something along those lines again. Of course, you know that I just recently did, not too very long, with Luke Clayton, the book called Campfire Talk, and also another one that I did by myself called Deer Addictions, about hunting the different deer species, native deer species, if you will, from all the way up in Alaska with the Sitka blacktail, going down to the Columbian blacktail along the western coast of the North American U.S., and then also the Rocky Mountain mule deer and the desert mule deer, and then, of course, the regular whitetail that you find all over, and wrote about hunting in different places there scattered throughout North America. And then down in the southwest of U.S. and North America, the Coos whitetail, and then a little bit farther south of there, even the Brocket deer. And those were absolutely great hunts that I was able to do over those years. And again, I got an opportunity to meet a lot of different people, and we'll talk about some of the questions that were asked about some of those hunts in the future. Those books can be found on my website, which is larrywysoon.net. Of course, www.larrywysoon.net. And you can order those books there, read a bunch of the blogs that I do, listen to this podcast, and also even view the A Sportsman's Life that I do with Luke Clayton and Jeff Rice. So kind of a fun website. We're about to get it all set up to where you can also get in touch with me there in case you'd like to hear about something or have some comments or things that you don't want to hear about on the podcast as well, too. But what I thought we'd do today is just run through a few questions that recently came up, and we'll try to answer those. And again, if I don't know the answer, I'll tell you, because I can make up stories and all that kind of thing, and occasionally I will do that, but I'll tell you before I finish the podcast or whatever that, hey, that was just totally made up, and let's see if we can find out what really the case is. But let's start with the first one. This came from a gentleman named, just going to call him Ed. He's from up in Northeast Texas, and he says, with spring coming on, what are some of the things you suggest planting primarily for white-tailed deer? Ed, over the years, we've used food plots a lot of different places. And generally, in terms of food plots, I think more in terms of fall, because a lot of times in the springtime, we've got a fair amount of nutrition coming on. There's a lot of natural nutrition in a lot of different places, and certain areas of the state, and Northeast Texas being a little bit different, because there you do have soil and topsoil, that is, and you do have rainfall. So those two are really important when it comes to growing anything. And of course, if you're going to plant something, one of the things you want to do is to always do a soil sample. You can get in touch with a local county agriculture extension agent that's usually found, his office is usually found somewhere close to the courthouse or whatever the county seat of your county or township is. And that happens to be the case whether you live anywhere in the USA. In the Southeast, again, nutrition runs really high during the springtime. It's usually in the wintertime that deer really hurting, kind of thing. And so in the springtime, a lot of the things that we've had so much success with is the different types of beans or peas, if you will. I'm a big proponent of planting some variety of cowpeas. And now, the ones that we do in a lot of Texas and in a lot of areas, because they are very forgiving, and for the most part, when they're eaten down, they'll keep coming back. That is iron clay peas. These can be gotten usually at a local feed and seed dealer. You don't have to buy them in a fancy bag somewhere. And they can provide you with a seeding rate for what they suggest in that area. Some of the times we've planted these in rows. Sometimes we've also broadcast them and just kind of plowed up an area, disc it real well, ran a broadcast seeder over the top of it, and then pulled a drag back behind it just to kind of cover it. You don't need to plant them very deeply. The thing about the iron clay peas is, as I mentioned, they grow in a great variety of soil. They do well in, it gets a little hotter. They do well when it's dry. They do well really in anything, probably except for really wet type soils. We found these years ago during a drought. They'd been used many years ago in a lot of different places, but we found these growing on a railroad track, next to a railroad track, I guess I should say, down in Cotulla, Texas, during a really bad drought. And it was the only green area anywhere around. And to begin with, we weren't even really sure what they were. Excuse me, but apparently there'd been a shipment and on a railroad track, and some of them fell out, or there may have been an accident, and a bunch of the beans or peas spilled and grew right there. But there were a lot of deer there, and you could tell that those things had been eaten on quite a bit, and that they seemed to resprout. And as a result of that, we finally ran down what they were, and once we did that, I found a seed source with them. Farm rather, and we planted them in several different places, including up into oh my gosh, as far north as in almost the edge of the high country of Colorado, and all throughout the Midwest, and a few other places in the southeast, and up in the northeast, and even some of the western states that I consider western states, like parts of New Mexico. We played around with them there a little bit as well too, and they seem to grow really well. So it's a plant that seems to do really good in a great variety of soil types, and a great variety of I guess you could say, in terms of rainfall as well, too. So something you might consider. And again, they're available, excuse me, as I said, at the local feed and seed dealer. There's another pea that we've used quite a bit in the past, too, called Chinese red, or a lot of times you call it here called Chinese red, but it's spelled like Chinese. And this one, too, does well in a great variety of soil types. And it, too, can be purchased at the local feed and seed dealer. One of the things we're doing this year on a piece of property up in the northeast part of the state of Texas is we've got an area that we've gone into. It was native grass. It's not, probably was a field back in the 1940s and 50s, but I don't think anything's been planted there since then, not specifically for wildlife at least. And what we did, we went in there and we took a shredder, if you will, or a mower, and there was a fair amount of old vegetation, and we wanted to knock that out and off as much as we could. And then we went in and we really disked that area using a disc and crisscrossed it numerous times. And we probably would have used a plow if we'd had one and then a disc, but we didn't have a plow on that particular property. And I just wanted to kind of play around and field test a few little things there. And what we've done is, after we went in and really crossed this thing several times with the disc to kind of try to break up not only the topsoil, but also to kind of get rid of a little bit of the grass and other vegetation that was there. And once we completed that, we went in and we just broadcast seed corn, just like field corn, and milo, and then overseeded it later with a little bit of the iron clay peas in strips. After we did that, we kind of ran a drag over it and just to kind of plant it a little bit. Now, there's a lot of hogs in this area as well, too. And one of the things that I was trying to avoid with the planting it in rows or going in, actually, if we'd had the chance, I'd have probably done it the same way, that I would have gone in and disc it rather than plow it and plant corn in rows, because the hogs have a way of working their way right down the rows, and next thing you know, all your seed corn is gone. So the area that we planted is probably about 8-9 acres, so pretty good sized place. We'll see what happens. The hog population there has been on the decrease because of the numbers that are being taken off, but I really kind of wanted to see what was going to happen with doing it that way. I've not done it that way in the past, but with the milo and the corn, it should produce a fair amount of grain. Now, that area too, that ranch too, does a little bit of waterfowl. Not so much for hunting, just for the enjoyment of having it there, although they do hunt it on occasion. Part of that property used to be part of an operation, where they did commercial waterfowl hunting. So they've got some Some areas that they can flood, the areas that are natural kind of that way, but also areas that they can flood. And so from a waterfowl perspective, you know, it's going to provide a little bit of food and that kind of thing. But basically, we're trying to really grow the corn. Excuse me. And it's springtime here in Texas, and everything is blooming, and I'm feeling the results of it. But I just want to get in there and see what's going to happen, quite frankly. And we're going to go in later on, and we'll knock down some of the corn, kind of leave some of it standing, and it'll be kind of a fun place to hunt as far as I'm concerned. It may be an area that we don't so much concentrate on taking bucks, but it might be a really good area away from my other hunting areas where we can take a fair number of does. So I'll kind of keep you informed of how that goes. We've just gone in and we've just planted really with just in the last few days now, and we'll see what happens. But on the food plot thing, don't forget about those iron clay peas. They are some of the best deer browse, as far as I'm concerned, of peas. There's also grazing soybeans that you can put in during springtime. And years ago, we did a fair amount with a bean called the mung bean, and it did really well for us at Will, too. That was back when we were having a hard time getting iron clay peas. So that's also a possibility. But and again, in these instances, what we're doing, rather than row planting them, we may go in certain areas with a planter and plant the cowpeas, but in some instances too, we're just going to go out there and kind of broadcast it and then drag over it and see kind of what happens. But I know this plant does really well, and I think if you try it, I think you too will kind of find that you kind of like it as well too. So one of the good things, there's all kinds of other things you can plant, but I like to try to keep it as simple as I possibly can. Generally, when somebody asks me, you know, what can I plant in such and such area, my first question generally is always, is there any farming going on? And if the answer is yes, I go, okay, go to that local farmer and ask him what he plants that he has more depredation on from deer than anything else. Now, that'll tell you several different things. He'll tell you that that plant grows in that area and the soil types and the climate conditions that you have in terms of rainfall. So that you know that. And you know, too, that deer like it because they are really eating it in that area. So those are really, really kind of the best advice I can give. If you just kind of trolling, trying to figure out what you might want to plant, if you got some agriculture going on and particularly row crops in that area, go to that farm and ask him. And then, you know, that it grows there, you know, the deer like it. And there's a really good chance that you can probably just go down to the local feed and seed dealer and buy the seeds there. So give it a try. See what you think. Going to go to a totally different topic real quickly here. I've got a moose hunt coming up this year with the Love Brothers and Lee up in British Columbia, thankfully set up through Mossberg, one of our sponsors. Miss Linda Powell set this hunt up for me. She knows I like to hunt moose, and we've got a couple other guys going, and I'm really looking forward to spending time up there with those folks. I understand it's going to be a call-in hunt to where we're going to get in a boat and kind of cruise the edge of the several lakes in the area and try to call these bulls in. It'll be in late September, early October. For the most part, I think the rut as a whole might be a little bit over, but a lot of times, kind of like when rattling in South Texas or wherever you rattle, sometimes after the rut's over with a little bit, or they're still, bucks are still interested, sometimes you can rattle up some really big old bucks that didn't appear earlier. So kind of hoping that's what's going to happen with this moose hunt. But setting it up, this comes from a guy by the name of Joe D. from Arkansas. He says, I'm going on my first moose hunt this year in BC, same place that I'm going. I normally hunt with a 308. Will this work, or should I try to get another rifle? If so, if you think I need another rifle, what would you suggest? Now, Joe D., I have to tell you, the first moose I killed, I shot back in 1995 with an Encore, TC Encore, single-shot handgun, and it was in a 308 using 180-grain Hornady bullet, and I can't remember the exact bullet, but it was 180 grain Hornady and a 308. shot that moose a couple of times, and it did not go very far. A short time after that, I had also that year drawn a permit in Colorado for Shire's moose. And hard hunt that I did with Jim Zumbo, but on the last afternoon, essentially, we spotted a legal bull and slipped in on him, and again, using that same 308 handgun, which at the time we didn't even know what the name of it was going to be. Back then I was on staff with Shooting Times, and I was covering the introduction of the Encore, and slipped in there, and sure enough, I was able to put this moose on the ground, and again with the Hornady 180 grain 308. Shot other moose with 30-06 handguns, again Hornady ammo, and shot one in British Columbia a few years ago up on the Prophet Musquaw area with the 375 H&H. Again, back then I was doing a lot of things with the TC Encore, and that one in a rifle. But yes, moose can be taken, of course, obviously, with the 308. Now, that's with proper shot placement, of putting it through the heart and lungs, not trying to drive it through their really tough shoulders, just waiting for that shot where you have that perfect broadside shot. And generally, with moose, that can be the case. Those moose, even if they come into call, from the little bit we've been able to do it that way, they'll come in, but then they may turn one way or the other, and you're not trying to drive it through the shoulder in a quartering two or even a quartering away shot. But I will be open with you, as I always would. If I had the opportunity to either buy another rifle, borrow another rifle, or whatever, I will tell you that on this moose hunt that I'm going on this year, I am taking a 375 Ruger. Now, I've shot all kinds of things with 375 Ruger, from elephants down to buffalo and hippo and African lion and a 1,400 pound Alaskan brown bear and huge, oh my gosh, huge in terms of body size, eland over in Africa. And to me, I've often made the statement here ever since I started using it that if I had just one round, one caliber that I could use to hunt the world with, it would be the 375 Ruger, and particularly either in in Hornady's Outfitter ammo, or the DGX ammo and the 300 grain there. I've had such great success, particularly with that latter, with the 300 grain. It's just kind of a soft point. And shooting some of these other huge, huge animals with that being the case, you have to realize that these moose, and if you've never hunted a moose, oh my gosh, they're so much fun to hunt, and they're kind of like hunting big whitetail in a way, in some absolutely fantastic habitat and terrain and country. But they're also absolutely huge. I mean, you think a horse is big. Well, you know, even a big horse like some of the draft horses, that's about the size of what these moose are. And I'm not so sure they don't stand taller at the shoulder and all that kind of thing. And they can be really tough to bring down. Now, a lot of times they can absorb a lot of shots. Essentially, they're almost dead at that first shot if you properly placed it. But, you know, to me, I'm one of those, I keep shooting until that animal is down and not moving. And for those that say, well, you're going to lose some meat. No, you really, really don't lose that much meat. And on those second, third, and fourth follow-up shots, if you need to, particularly if you're putting it through the heart and lung area, you might lose a little bit of that meat that's there between the ribs, but it's very minimal meat loss when you get right down to it, particularly on those broadside shots. So if you've got the opportunity to, and it sounds to me like you may be looking for permission, if you will, or encouragement to buy a new rifle, I would certainly consider doing so, particularly for moose. And you know, you're going on your first moose hunt, it probably won't be your last one. You'll probably want to go hunt elk if you haven't already done so, or there's some other species of big bodies that you might want. And even in terms of shooting longer ranges, with the 375 Ruger with the Hornady ammo, we shot at ranges out to 750 yards. That was on the range, not in animals, although there is more than sufficient downrange energy at that distance to really put down an animal very quickly and humanely. So, you know, that's something to consider as well, too. Most time with moose, you're going to get relatively close. So the moose that I've shot, I think the farthest that I've ever been away from one of them, it may have been a little over 100 yards. And that's usually closer, though. Usually that 50 to 75 yards is to me what a good moose hunt is. And but yes, you know, you need to be prepared to, if you find that one that you've been looking for all your life, you might want to take a shot a little bit longer, but be sure you practice at those longer ranges before you go too. But you know, if I were going to buy a rifle, that's really what it would be. It for a moose hunt or for an elk hunt, ammunition is available everywhere now. Hornady has done just an absolutely fabulous job of not only producing 375 ammo, but getting it into the hands of dealers scattered all the way around. And as far as the rifle that I would choose, I've gotten to be where I really like these Mossberg Patriot rifles, or the Mossberg Patriot Predator. And I've been shooting those on 7mm PRC, and I just ordered one at 6.5 PRC as well, too. And actually, that 7 PRC is probably big enough to, or certainly is big enough to bring down a moose. But it's also available in the 375. Now, it comes with a threaded muzzle, so should you wish to put a can on it or a suppressor, you could certainly do so, or a muzzle brake. The recoil on those 375 Rugers is not substantial. Now, that's a little bit more than that 308 that you're shooting, but were you to put a muzzle brake on it, it would probably be about like shooting a .30-06. At least that's been my experience. I've had the opportunity to shoot that 375 a lot in different rifles, and I've got one now with the Mossberg Predator, and I really, really like that gun. The thing about 375s is, there was one thing I could recommend to Mossberg and some of these other companies, I have to give Ruger credit. I was along with Ruger, and they had the guide rifle, which M77 guide rifle, excuse me, and with a 20-inch barrel, essentially. And that 20-inch barrel, 375s do really well in relatively short barrels. And with most of the other 375s that are out there, the barrels are 22, 24. By the time you put a suppressor on one of them, you're talking about a really long barrel. And if you're going to be hunting in fairly thick cover, which you could be in trying to get on stalking an animal, particularly depending on where you're hunting and how you're hunting in British Columbia, that could be a really long barrel. So, you know, but I wish that Mossberg would start producing 20-inch barrels. I've been talking to Jesse Beard with Aviant, and they produce the polymer barrels. And we'll have Jesse back on here and some of their engineers for too very long. And I'm trying to see if perhaps they can do a 20-inch 375 or 7 PRC barrel that I can put onto my Mossberg Predator, if you will. And even the 7 PRC does really well in a 20-inch barrel. You don't really lose that much downrange or velocity or downrange energy kind of thing. So that would be my suggestion if you could do that. But I certainly would suggest the 375. There's all kinds of other uses for it. I've used it a bunch on white-tailed deer. I hunted with it. The smallest things I've shot with it. On one trip, I shot probably 2,000-pound eland and a little blue diker that was maybe 5 pounds, something like that, on the same trip using the same gun. So I've used it a bunch on whitetails here in North American and on black bear and even on big brown bear and grizzly bear and all that other kind of thing too, and gray elk cartridge as well. So please consider that one. Could you take that moose with a 308? Yeah, you certainly can. And if that's what you want to do, I would strongly suggest using a good penetrating bullet, such as those CX bullets that you can get from Hornady or maybe in an outfitter load, that a lot of times that's what they're loaded in. But that would be my choice in terms of a 308. But again, I'd have a serious look at that 375 Ruger, and I don't think you'll go wrong with it. I'm just a very strong believer in that particular cartridge. We've got a bunch of other questions here. We're going to probably just do maybe another, here just a few others. This is one. This is from a gentleman named Arnie over in Georgia. And he said, just finished your new Dear Dixon book. Really, really like it. It's actually a handwritten note that was handed me, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what his writing is. His handwriting is very much similar to mine, which is tough to read. I was happening to be doing some a thing at the DSC, and back in January, and he handed me this note, and I finally recovered it, and he says, he says, I think I got it. He said, he continues, he does continue, especially enjoyed the chapter of hunting coos deer. I'm very interested in hunting coos deer in the future, and I'm thinking about using the 6.5 PRC. I understand some of these shots can be really long, and he's right. They can be. The coos deer is one of my favorite animals to hunt anywhere. I dearly, dearly love hunting coos deer. A lot of times it's like hunting desert bighorn sheep, but most of the time when you're hunting coos deer, they have a tendency to stay up in the highest country wherever they are. I've hunted in Sonora numerous times, right in there where our old legendary Jack O'Connor hunted. I was up on top of a mountain looking down on desert bighorn sheep, and way off down in the valleys, I could, with a spotting scope, I could occasionally see a mule deer, but the coos deer, or cow's deer, however you want to pronounce it, they were right there on basically the same level I was, right at the very top of everything. So those deer blend in so extremely well with their surroundings. And a lot of times you have to look for just a flicker of an ear, or maybe the shine of a nose, or their eyes, or a glint off an antler. And then too, on occasion, I've found them by glassing rocks, if you will, because a lot of times they would bed down in front of a rock somewhere, and you would actually see the shadow of those deer. Sometimes, you know, you could see the antlers that way as well too, just a shadow on the rock. So very, very, there's a reason they're called the ghosts of the desert, the gray ghosts of the desert, and they are. And I know that once you start hunting them, you'll be like me. Even though I've not got to hunt them as much as I wanted to, there are animals that I cannot wait to go back and hunt. Trying to set up a hunt this year with Ted Jaycox with Tall Tines Outfitting that Ted has these days. I know Linda Powell has taken several people down there. And you know, when you hunt, as Ted does and a lot of those guys do who guide, you spend a tremendous amount of time walking into an area and just sitting there and glassing sometimes for hours. And occasionally those deer will get up and move, just to move to get to you shade. Or as I mentioned, a lot of times, depending on how cool it is, they may stay in the same spot. I've also seen those deer walk to an area and bed down, and I'd crawl up to there closer and sit there and glass and glass and glass. Never see them. There's no way that I thought they could get out of this little pocket that they were in. And finally, as the evening gets to sun going down for too very long, I've walked to those areas and walked out that 10, 15 square yard area where that deer bedded, and he wasn't there. And how he got out of there, I have no earthly idea. Fascinating little deer. A really good one will score about 100 Boone and Crockett scores. Now, in most places, if you're interested in bigger white-tailed deer, you know, that's a decent yearling, or a good yearling in a lot of areas, and a lot of 2 or 3 year old good deer. But, you know, for the most part, if you're interested in big antlers on white-tailed deer, you don't need to hunt coos deer or cow's deer, because because 120, 130 is absolutely a true monster. It's like a well over, almost like a 200 class whitetail, regular whitetail. I've been very fortunate. I've shot a few, never as many as I wanted to, but I've got one that made Boone and Crockett. And I generally don't enter a lot of things in Boone and Crockett record book, even though I'm a professional member there in that. But this deer deserved it. I mean, he was a buck that I shot at long range, and it was with a 30-06 of all things, and it was right at 800 yards, and there just wasn't any way to get closer. But I'd shot that rifle a bunch using Hornady ammo, their American Whitetail load, and I'd shot that rifle a lot out to, actually even out to 1,000 yards. Most of the time I was concentrating at that 700 to 800 yards because I've been in situations where we just couldn't get any closer, no matter what you did. To me, the fun comes in getting closer, but you know, sometimes you've got to be prepared to take those long shots if you're interested in particular taking a particular animal that you spotted. So your choice in 6.5 PRC is an excellent choice. The one that I'm getting, I'm planning on shooting the Hornady Precision Hunter 143 grain ELDX, which has been just an absolutely fantastic bullet as a whole of everything that I've shot at it. Now, I've not tried to shoot some of the really, really big game with it, but, you know, I've shot everything up to elk with it, and it's done extremely well. If I get an opportunity to again use that particular or one of the PRCs, it will probably be that I will use the CX bullet, which is essentially like an all copper type bullet that allows for a little bit deeper penetration as opposed to the ELDX bullet. But either one, particularly on coos deer, whichever one your individual rifle shoots better, that's the one that I would go with. I keep talking about Hornady because I've been using Hornady for a long, long time. Going back to, gosh almighty, I can't even remember back that far ago. So, and it's never let me down in of anything that I've ever shot with it. If I have made a bad shot, so be it. There were times that I have made a bad shot. It does happen. I got excited. I rushed the shot, and I didn't put the bullet exactly where it should have been. So, but yes, you got me running off in different things, making having me remember all kinds of different things here, Arnie, and as I'm talking about this. But definitely the PRC 6.5 would be an ideal bullet, ideal cartridge and load to use in the ELDX or the CX, either one of them, because again, these are long bullets, and so they stabilize. They have a very high ballistic coefficient, and they do well at ranges, whether you're shooting relatively close or at a long distance in terms of thermal performance of that bullet. Be prepared to spend a lot of hours when you're on the hunt sitting and glassing and maybe walking a little way and sitting and glassing some more. With the rifle, I would strongly recommend a really good scope with a little bit more magnification, you know, maybe at 4-16 or at least a 3-12 kind of thing, because generally you are going to may have to shoot that long distance for the one that you're after. I would spend some time, if I could, shooting at distances where I was also in practicing with kind of broken country, because of that's what you're going to be in, and you're going to be dealing with all kinds of different wind factors. So I would try to learn as much as I could about reading the wind before you go, because when you start shooting across those canyons, a lot of times you'll have wind directions going from from just about everything except for straight up and straight down, and sometimes I think you've got those working against you as well too. But spend a lot of time, be very familiar with your rifle. Be sure you get one if you're going to have something above 10 power where you have some parallax adjustment. If you're going to use a scope with holdover, learn how to hold the proper holdover at different distances out to, say, 700-800 yards. If you are using a turret that you can turn up or turn down, or, you know, the wind I usually just hold into or in one way or the other rather than doing a windage adjustment there. But learn how to do it quickly. Learn to remember to, once you have dialed up, to when you are looking at something or you, and don't get the shot, that you remember to dial back down to the 100-yard area, so that if you happen to see one fairly close, that you're not going to be shooting way over that rascal. But I think you're going to absolutely love coos deer hunting. I do. Like I said, I'm trying to find another place to go, and hopefully Ted will have an opening. He's very good about letting those who hunted with him previously in the past have the first right at the hunts, and if he's got an opening, I will definitely go. If not, I may try to find another spot. There's a couple other outfitters that I know down there. I've done a bunch of work in Mexico in years past with Royal Trevino, who with some partners has a company called Amavisi, and they do biology work for a lot of the different ranchers down there and help them in with their management program. And Roel's always been a good source for me and has helped me put me on some really good hunts all over Mexico in the past. But Ted and I go back a long way, and I'd really like to hunt with him. So I'm hoping that is what's going to happen. We've got time maybe for one more question today. I've got some things going on. I'm actually going to go visit with a gentleman about a new optic that I'm real interested in, a new hunting optic. And not going to tell you much about it right now, but I will tell you that I'm going to meet with him here in a couple of hours, and maybe after we have an opportunity to look at that new product, I will have him here on the podcast as well too, because, you know, I've just finished a blog, and it's called The Aging Hunter. And being in that category, I no longer walk as far as what I did. I can still walk long distances, but sometimes it takes a long time to get there compared to what it did in the past. But in so doing, I know I've learned that I see a whole lot more game, because I'm not looking at the destination. I'm looking at the surroundings as I'm walking, and walking slower. And as a result, I've seen a lot more game. And in certain instances, I have seen bigger animals than what I was going after to begin with. So that was a good thing. But I've always been one of those that, to me, getting as close as possible before making the shot, that's where hunting comes in. And I've always loved shooting long ranges at steel, and have done so. But it was mainly so that when I got close in, I could make the shot. Well, with being one of those aging hunters that as many of us are, and I'm not quite there to where I may be able to get that, cut that 1,000 yards down to 150. I may end up having to maybe take that shot at 400 and 500 yards. And so to me, one of the things I'm really looking at with this new optic is how well it performs at those distances. And again, I will have the gentleman that did these come on the podcast with me and have him explain. I'm pretty sure I'm going to like this scope. I've looked at it a little bit, photographs that he sent and all those kind of things, and talked to a couple of guys that shot it. So why don't we just cut it off right there? We'll come back maybe in another couple of weeks and do some more Q&A. I've got several very interesting guests coming on. Of course, one of our regulars has been Jim Bequette. Jim, I think, will have been on before I did this, but Jim and I will have tried to do another one for too very long. Dr. Mike Arnold, who's become a very dear friend, I'll have Dr. Mike back on here for long. He's been over in England hunting Chinese water deer and muntjac, something that's been on my list for a long time. Got some other old friends coming up, trying to get in touch with Bob Folkrod and Mark Kaiser and J. Wayne Fears and some of the other guys I used to spend a lot of time with. Maybe even Bill Miller, if we can run him down. Bill used to be with the North American Hunting Club, was a dear friend for a long time. Still is. I just don't get to see the rascal anymore. So we got a bunch of those kind of people coming up here in the future, and really look forward to you joining me right back here next week. And in the meantime, let us know what you think. There's a lot of different ways you can do so. There's an internet page that you can go that's just Larry Wysoon Outdoors, and you can leave a message there, or you can get in touch with me at Facebook at Larry Wysoon. And as I said before, too very long, we'll have this email set up on LarryWysoon.net as well, too, and I'll let you know about that one. But in the meantime, get out there and enjoy the outdoors. Great time to go fishing right now. Great time to go buy a new gun and start practicing with it and start planning your hunts for the fall if you haven't already done so. And a lot of great things out there to enjoy the outdoors. And enjoy them with your youngsters, too. Get those kids out there and take them fishing, you know, and take them squirrel hunting. Take them just for a walk looking for shed antlers. All those great things that can be done right now and are fun to do as a family. Look forward to catching up with y'all all right back here next week, same time, same place.
DSC's Campfires has also been brought to you by the Crown Bar in LaGrange, Texas, Habit, Our Gear, Your Adventure, the Texas Wildlife Association, Double Nickel Taxidermy, Burnham Brothers Game Calls, and H3 Whitetail Solutions.
You want to succeed, you want to fish, you want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.